Welcome back to The Deep Dive. I'm Alex Johnson. We're here to navigate the complex and often really hidden machinations of the U.S. federal government.
And I'm Sam Kennedy, ready to sort through what was, you know, a really fascinating end to the year, a lot of strategic moves, and a lot of bureaucratic inertia.
The title of this deep dive is The Federal News Update for Monday, December 29th, 2025.
And when you hear a title like that, it just evokes images of, you know, quiet offices, half-eaten holiday cookies.
Yeah, a few security guards making their rounds. A general slowdown, right?
You'd think so.
That is precisely the deceptive cover we're here to rip off. Our mission today is to provide you with a granular MECE that's mutually exclusive, collectively exhaustive report on every key action and activity of the U.S. federal government since Christmas Day, December 25, 2025.
And we're not just listing events here.
No. We are going to dissect the impact and the implications of each and every one of these actions in, well, in exhaustive, granular detail.
And that approach is so critical for this period because from Christmas through that Monday, the 29th, it was just a complete paradox.
How so?
Well, on the surface, the government was dormant. There was this executive mandated holiday pause. But, you know, beneath that veneer of quiet, we saw a period of absolute hyperactivity.
In the administrative, judicial, and strategic realms.
Exactly. And it revealed these deep systemic frictions. We're talking about huge constitutional conflicts around federalism, high-stakes moves for technological supremacy, and some really calculated political retribution boiling over in the court.
Okay, so let's unpack this deceptive quiet first. We really have to start with the operational reality that dictated the flow of this short work week.
Yeah, the executive branch put a pause in place.
But that pause came with a giant asterisk.
A giant asterisk is the perfect way to put it. The official calm was, you could say, legislated into existence thanks to Executive Order 14371.
This was signed the week before, right? On December 18th.
That's right. And it was a strategic move, really, designed to give federal workers a break.
So can you break down what that order actually did? Because it really set the stage for everything that followed and, you know, explains why that Monday was so chaotic.
Sure. The order was titled Providing for the Closing of Executive Departments and Agencies of the Federal Government on December 24, 2025 and December 26, 2025.
So Wednesday and Friday.
Exactly. Section 1 explicitly mandated the closure of most non-essential executive departments on that Wednesday and Friday. And when you look at the calendar, Christmas was Thursday, then you had the weekend. It created this effective 5-day pause in routine government operations.
Right, running from December 24th all the way through the 28th.
Yep.
Now, that sounds like an excellent benefit for federal personnel, but this is where that institutional resilience comes into play, isn't it? Because the order had a crucial escape clause.
It did. And that clause ensured that the really high stakes work continued, you know, completely uninterrupted.
This is Section 2.
That was Section 2, the National Security and Public Need Exception. It allowed agency heads to keep offices open for reasons of national security, defense, or other public need.
And that phrase, other public need, that feels intentionally vague.
Oh, it's a loophole large enough for every agency dealing with a hot-button issue to drive right through. And we saw massive use of this clause.
By who, specifically?
Well, agencies like ICE, Customs and Border Protection, the Department of Justice, State Department, and, of course, the Department of Defense. This wasn't a universal vacation. The legal and crisis response teams were absolutely slammed.
So if the routine work stopped, but the critical work just kept on going, what was the administrative result of that? You mentioned a bottleneck effect.
That bottleneck is, I think, the most fascinating operational impact of this whole period. All those routine, non-critical administrative actions, you know, publishing rules, notices, policy statements, regulatory findings that matured during that 5-day closure.
From the 24th to the 28th.
Right. They were all held back. They just had to wait until the government officially reopened for business on Monday, December 29th.
And the evidence of this pent-up workload, it's pretty staggering.
It is. When the administrative state finally hit the publish button, the results were just overwhelming. The Federal Register, and for listeners who might not know, that's the daily journal of the U.S. government where all the rules and notices are officially published.
It's the official record.
It's the official record. It printed a monumental volume on December 29th. It contained 126 separate documents.
And it spanned a staggering 488 pages.
488 pages in one day.
That volume is, I mean, it's a physical representation of bureaucracy's sheer relentless momentum. Despite a top-down executive mandate for a holiday pause, The rulemaking machinery didn't stop at all.
No, it just banked the output and then dumped it all at once. It really demonstrates the incredible resilience of the administrative state. You can close the doors, but the regulatory processes that dictate how banks operate, how food is grown, how trade is conducted, they're just unstoppable.
And while the bureaucracy was silently compiling this massive list of rules, the executive branch was also making some highly visible, very strategic moves.
Yeah, mostly centered on technology and global dominance.
Okay, let's shift our focus right there to those strategic moves. I'm thinking particularly of techno-nationalism and the militarization of space. This is where the White House used the quiet of Christmas Day to deliver a very specific, very strategic message.
Precisely. On December 25th, the White House released a presidential message. It was marking the 6th birthday of the United States Space Force, the USSF.
And this wasn't just, you know, some standard holiday filler.
No, not at all. This was a strategic signaling document about the future of global power. The message explicitly and immediately linked the Space Force's existence and its mission to a recent presidential directive, Executive Order 14369, which was titled Ensuring American Space Superiority.
So what were the core pillars of that message, and how did they justify this, this massive ongoing investment in what is still a relatively new branch of the military?
Well, the first pillar was crucial for internal validation: recruitment success. The message highlighted that the Space Force had, and I'm quoting here, shattered expectations by meeting its annual recruiting goals 3 months early.
And that's a really important detail, isn't it? Because it runs counter to the narrative that the USSF is, you know, struggling for relevance or for talent.
It's extremely important, especially when you look at sister branches like the Army and the Navy, which have been struggling immensely with recruitment shortfalls. This success frames the USSF as appealing to that young, technically proficient demographic that's so vital for future warfare.
A very strong operational validation. The second pillar, though, that seems to weave together military might and scientific research in a very deliberate way.
It absolutely does. The message made a key reference to what they call the Genesis mission, a recently launched initiative. The president stated this mission was designed to supercharge scientific discovery and technological leadership.
So you have the president conflating the mission of a military branch with pure scientific discovery.
Which is a clear signal. The strategy is to leverage dual-use technology. Military funding, military focus, military assets, they're all being strategically aligned to underwrite and ultimately dominate the commercial and scientific aspects of the space economy.
It's an explicit integration of military and scientific assets, then.
Yes, designed to ensure comprehensive superiority.
And finally, the language they used to describe the space domain itself, it solidified a fundamental doctrinal shift that national security experts have been tracking for years.
The language was the most aggressive we've seen publicly. The president stated, "When America leads in space, America wins, and our military remains the strongest, most feared, and most lethal in every sphere of battle."
Every sphere of battle. That phrase is key.
It confirms the official U.S. doctrinal shift. Space is no longer treated abstractly as some global commons that has to be protected. It's now, you know, unequivocally deemed a contested theater of war, a war-fighting domain, just like air, sea, land, and cyber.
And this focus on global technological dominance wasn't just limited to orbit, was it? It came right down to the ground, specifically with the implementation of the 6G spectrum directive.
It's a classic battle over the radio waves, which are, you know, the lifeblood of modern communication. This move stems from the Winning the 6G Race presidential memorandum,
which was signed just a week before the holiday on December 19th.
Right. But it was being actively executed by commerce agencies during this administrative pause. The goal is to rapidly clear and repurpose specific radio frequency spectrum.
Okay, let's get into the weeds on the technical conflict here.
Okay.
Because it's a direct clash between the commercial future and current military capability.
The technical detail revolves around the 7.125 to 7.4 gigahertz band. This is 275 megahertz of spectrum, and it's highly desirable. It's what they call prime mid-band spectrum.
Why is it so valuable?
It offers an excellent balance of capacity and range for commercial 6G deployment, which is the next generation of wireless technology. But this band is currently occupied by federal incumbents.
Mainly the Department of Defense.
Mainly the DoD. They use it for classified tactical communications, high-power radar, and very sensitive satellite uplinks.
So the president's directive essentially overrode direct Pentagon objections to giving up this crucial operational spectrum. I mean, that's a huge move. Why the aggression?
The strategic rationale is crystal clear. The administration views commercial telecom dominance as an inseparable national security priority. The memo says it is the policy of the United States to lead the world in 6G development.
Which is a direct reaction to the 5G era.
Absolutely. In 5G, Chinese firms like Huawei gained a substantial early lead in setting standards and deploying infrastructure. So by forcing the Pentagon to find new spectrum and submit relocation plans within 12 months, the White House is ensuring American carriers and equipment manufacturers define the standards for 6G. It's about maintaining technological sovereignty.
And what was the reception to this high-stakes executive push? Did the industry immediately support essentially forcing the Pentagon's hand?
Oh, absolutely. There was immediate and strong support. Organizations like the Wireless Infrastructure Association, the WIA, they immediately praised the move, calling the release of this 275 megahertz of spectrum a vital first step.
So it perfectly illustrates how tightly the administration is aligning its industrial policy with its national security objectives.
Exactly. The telecommunications sector is now, for all intents and purposes, viewed as an extension of the defense apparatus in the global tech war.
Okay, so the theme of aggressive proactive action shifts now from technological spectrum battles to, well, to kinetic battles.
Right.
These move to defense and international affairs, specifically the U.S. strikes in Nigeria around Christmas Day.
Right. These were targeted U.S. strikes against identified ISIS elements operating in Nigeria. The administration was very quick to stress that the operation was fully coordinated and executed in conjunction with Nigerian intelligence services and their military.
Which is key for maintaining diplomatic ties and operational legitimacy.
Absolutely.
But the narrative surrounding why these strikes happened immediately became politically charged. And it highlighted a divide between the administration's messaging and the reality on the ground in Nigeria.
That's the core conflict here. The administration's stated rationale, which was heavily promoted by the president and other officials, was explicitly framed through a religious lens.
They said it was about combating the slaughter of Christians in the country.
Right. We saw the president issue a statement saying, "Merry Christmas to all, including the dead terrorists, of which there will be many more if their slaughter of Christians continues." That rhetoric is a clear political calculation. It appeals directly to the administration's base, which tends to view these global conflicts through a lens of Christian-centric protectionism.
But if we look at the source material, the Nigerian government immediately pushed back on that specific religious narrative, didn't they? They had a different primary motivation for taking part.
They pushed back significantly. I mean, the Nigerian government is absolutely unified with the U.S. in taking military action against ISIS. But their position is that the violence is driven by terrorism, pure and simple.
And that both Christians and Muslims are being targeted.
Exactly. They want the focus to remain on stability and security for all citizens, not on one specific religious persecution narrative, which they see as potentially destabilizing their own internal politics. It's a subtle but really profound diplomatic rift over the interpretation of a military action.
And this action signals a broader, more aggressive military posture, according to the Defense Secretary.
Yes, Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth made statements confirming this as part of a systemic shift. He indicated that more aggressive U.S. military strikes and proactive interventions are forthcoming globally. When you look at the recent buildup around other contested zones, the consensus among analysts is that the U.S. military is moving into a decidedly more aggressive and proactive posture.
This aggressive shift brings us to another highly political international action. The State Department's censorship visa ban. This essentially weaponized immigration law for ideological enforcement just before the holiday.
This was a new, very expansive visa restriction policy rolled out by the State Department on December 23rd, and the stated target is defined as agents of the global censorship industrial complex.
I mean, that is intentionally broad language. Who exactly is the administration trying to restrict or punish with this?
They're targeting leaders and key officials from NGOs and foreign governments, especially in Europe, who have, quote, led organized efforts to coerce American platforms to censor, demonetize, and suppress American viewpoints.
So this is a clear attempt to use the immense power of visa access to enforce ideological boundaries.
It's a direct shot at European Union officials who are aggressively enforcing the Digital Services Act, or, you know, UK-based NGOs involved in tracking and flagging online disinformation.
What's the specific legal mechanism the State Department invoked. Because we're not talking about routine visa denials here.
No, this is using a very powerful, very high-stakes section of the Immigration and Nationality Act. They invoked INA Section 212A3.
And why is that section so powerful?
Because it allows for the inadmissibility of any alien whose entry would have potentially serious adverse foreign policy consequences for the United States. So by labeling foreign regulatory compliance like a European official enforcing content rules as censorship that harms U.S. interests, the administration is effectively mandating its own national security view of the U.S. domestic information ecosystem onto foreign policy.
And the implication here goes far beyond just denying new people entry. It could affect people who are already here.
Yes, that's the critical point. The State Department statement also explicitly referenced INA Section 237A4C, and that section outlines grounds for removal for deportation for foreign policy reasons.
So this raises the unprecedented prospect of the U.S. potentially initiating removal proceedings against foreign tech execs or NGO leaders already living here legally.
Mm-hmm. If they're deemed part of this so-called censorship industrial complex, it's an aggressive embedding of America First policies deep within the regulatory code.
That is just a staggering use of administrative power.
Okay, let's pivot from that to domestic security and a crucial decision made by the Department of Defense right after Christmas on December 26th, modernizing its authentication policy and moving beyond the aging Common Access Card, the CAC.
This memo, Multi-Factor Authentication for Unclassified and Secret DoD Networks, was a massive operational necessity. For years, the CACAC, that physical ID card with the PKI chip, has been the primary credential.
But it's bulky. It needs specific readers.
Right. And it becomes impractical or infeasible for a lot of non-traditional users, like remote contractors, specialized researchers, or personnel in the field.
So what secure alternatives did the memo finally approve?
Well, the memo updates the list of approved authentication tools, and it fully embraces modern phishing-resistant technologies, things like FIDO pass keys and other PKI-enabled hardware tokens, like a modern YubiKey. So these are now explicitly approved alternatives when the SEEK system is too restrictive.
Correct.
It sounds like the DoD is catching up to the private sector here. But there was a significant technical controversy regarding what it didn't prohibit.
This is the friction point. While the DoD made strides in modernization, the memo stopped short of eliminating legacy, less secure methods. It continues to allow one-time passcodes, OTPs.
Those are the codes sent via phone, email, or text.
Exactly. And they're still allowed in specific, limited use cases, primarily for individuals in the early stages of recruitment or for non-mission critical training.
But the consensus among experts, and even across federal agencies like NIST and CISA, is that OTPs are fundamentally broken when facing modern phishing attacks. So why would the DoD allow them at all?
It's the operational flexibility paradox. The DoD has these massive recruitment and training pipelines. If they impose a hard PKI requirement, you know, a CAC or equivalent, immediately they risk grinding their intake to a halt.
So the use of OTPs is a concession to volume and speed for low-risk access.
It is. But the cybersecurity community is rightly critical because NIST, CISA, and OMB have all flagged OTPs as easily susceptible to being phished or intercepted, which really defeats the entire purpose of a zero-trust architecture.
And Congress has already weighed in on this, hasn't it? They've basically given the DoD a hard deadline to fix this conflict.
Exactly. Congress mandated a clear strategy. They required the DoD to develop a plan to ensure phishing-resistant authentication is used by all personnel. And critically, they mandated that legacy, phishable authenticators like OTPs must be retired entirely by the end of fiscal 2027.
So experts view this December 26th memo as a necessary first step, but it's still fundamentally out of step with that 2027 mandate.
It is. It's a perfect microcosm of the government's modernization struggle. The urgent need for machine speed, cutting-edge security, colliding with the operational inertia of a massive traditional enterprise that needs to onboard hundreds of thousands of people every year.
It's the friction point between mission effectiveness and cyber hygiene. Speaking of existential friction, the most significant events of this holiday period were not regulatory. They played out in the judicial branch. This was the epicenter of a major constitutional showdown over the limits of executive power. Let's start with the battle for the National Guard in Trump v. Illinois.
This case was, arguably one of the most significant legal clashes of the year. It involved a direct confrontation between the federal executive branch and a state governor over military authority.
Can you lay out the granular facts of the federal action?
Sure. The president federalized 300 members of the Illinois National Guard, along with units from the Texas National Guard. The administration cited the Insurrection Act and a specific section of the U.S. Code, claiming that local authorities were unable or unwilling to execute federal immigration laws.
And the stated mission was to protect a federal ICE facility in Chicago.
Protect the facility and enforce immigration laws in the metropolitan area. The governor of Illinois immediately sued, arguing this was a blatant overreach, that domestic law enforcement is a state police power, and the Insurrection Act's high bar, a complete breakdown of order, simply had not been met.
And the Supreme Court's action on December 23rd, just before the holiday, became the definitive ruling for the rest of the week.
Yes. In a major judicial check, the Supreme Court denied the administration's emergency application for a stay.
Which meant that the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals ruling against the administration stood.
It stood. And a denial on the shadow docket, you know, without a full hearing, often speaks louder than a signed opinion.
So what was the granular practical implication of that denial? It created this bizarre situation people were calling a ghost army.
That's exactly right. The legal reality created a ghost army scenario. The troops remained federalized, meaning they were on the federal payroll under the federal chain of command doing some administrative duties, but they were legally barred from deployment into any operational roles in Illinois.
So they could guard the federal facility, but they couldn't patrol or detain or enforce immigration laws outside that facility.
Correct. This ruling effectively neutralized the administration's strategy of using federalized state guard units to police hostile states against the governor's wishes.
That is a colossal loss for the executive branch's expansive view of the Insurrection Act.
Mm.
But we should note the administration's perspective, which was captured in the dissent.
It was. Justice Alito, joined by Justice Thomas, wrote a powerful dissent. Their argument was that the declarations submitted by federal officials, which alleged that ICE officers were being obstructed, threatened, and assaulted, should have been sufficient to trigger the president's statutory authority.
So they were arguing for maximum deference to the executive branch.
Pretty much. Deference in areas concerning national security and the enforcement of federal laws. But the majority's action cemented a judicial precedent. The judiciary will actively scrutinize and second-guess the president's factual determination regarding a breakdown of order in a state.
Which makes it much harder to unilaterally invoke the Insurrection Act.
Much harder.
So the Supreme Court was actively establishing limits on executive action, even during the holiday. And that constitutional crisis wasn't the only one pending. We also have the high-stakes financial independence case, Trump v. Cook, concerning the Federal Reserve.
Right. This involved the president's aggressive attempt to remove Federal Reserve Board Governor Lisa Cook for cause. The official stated cause was related to alleged deceitful and potentially criminal conduct concerning mortgage applications.
But the courts have consistently blocked the firing based on the long-standing principle of Fed independence.
Yes, a district court issued a preliminary injunction blocking the firing, specifically reinforcing the statutory independence of the Fed, which is vital to maintaining trust in the nation's central bank. The administration, through the Solicitor General, filed an emergency application to stay that injunction and allow the firing.
And that application, crucially, remained pending at the Supreme Court throughout the entire holiday week.
From the 25th through the 29th, yes.
So the delay itself, the inaction by the court during this week, is a form of major check on executive power.
It's passive resistance by the judiciary. The Supreme Court's refusal to grant an immediate administrative stay signaled a clear reluctance to destabilize the nation's central bank without a full briefing and hearing. This delay forces the administration to tolerate a regulator they strongly oppose, underscoring the formidable statutory protections and institutional independence of the Federal Reserve Board.
It's the institutional inertia of the financial system buffering a unilateral executive action.
That's a great way to put it.
And while those massive cases were pending, a significant individual victory against the administration's broader political retribution campaign occurred right after Christmas. The ruling regarding the whistleblower attorney, Mark Zayed.
On December 26th, U.S. District Judge Amir Ali blocked the March presidential memorandum that had attempted to summarily revoke Zayed's security clearance. Zayed is a very high-profile attorney, specializing in national security and whistleblower protection, and he had sued, arguing the revocation was an act of improper political retribution that essentially eliminated his ability to practice law.
And this wasn't an isolated incident, was it? Zayed was one target in a much broader, highly visible campaign.
Correct. The March memorandum singled out Zayed and 14 other individuals, including former high-ranking officials and lawyers like former Deputy Attorney General Lisa Monaco and New York Attorney General Letitia James. The administration has relied heavily on the summary revocation of security clearances as its favored tactic for imposing political and financial retribution.
Judge Ali's ruling is a huge win for due process then, and it established a critical legal precedent.
A huge win. The ruling essentially says, you cannot use summary clearance revocation as a political weapon. Judge Ali explicitly noted that the court joins the several others in this district that have enjoined the government from using the summary revocation of security clearances to penalize lawyers for representing people adverse to it.
So this decision blocks the use of this specific unilateral presidential action for retribution.
It does. However, the ruling was careful to clarify that the government can still use normal, lengthy agency processes to revoke his clearance if they can provide legitimate reasons, but it cannot be done instantly or summarily.
So if we look at the totality of these actions, the Illinois denial, the Cook delay, and the Zaid ruling, what narrative emerges about the Supreme Court's role during this hyperactive holiday period?
The overarching narrative is that the executive branch has leaned heavily on governing by litigation, using the emergency docket, the shadow docket, to implement policy rapidly. Over 30 Trump VX cases were filed by the administration in 2025 alone.
But the string of denials in late December suggests a pattern.
It does. The Illinois case and also the denial of a stay on December 19th in Margolin v. National Association of Immigration Judges, which protected the Immigration Judges Union, it all suggests the Supreme Court is acting as a necessary judicial break. A break on the administration's most aggressive unilateral moves that fundamentally challenge the separation of powers.
That is profound context. Okay, let's pivot entirely from those high-stakes legal battles and return to the executive branch's massive bureaucratic output. The December 29th Federal Register dump. This is where we see the administrative state quietly governing the granular details of life.
Yes, and the sheer volume itself, 126 documents, 488 pages, it just reminds us that regardless of political friction or holiday calendars, the administrative state is resilient. It just relentlessly promulgates rules that govern the economy, safety, and national security.
Let's start with financial deregulation. There was a significant action from the FDIC regarding the establishment and relocation of branches and offices. What was the core change here?
This final rule drastically shortens the approval timeline for bank branch relocation filings. Previously, the standard regulatory review period for such changes was 21 calendar days. That allowed local regulators and community groups time to organize public comments.
And the new rule changes that how?
Dramatically. Eligible filings are now deemed approved after only 3 business days following submission.
3 days. That is lightning fast. Why did the FDIC make this change, and what's the trade-off?
The rationale is pure regulatory burden reduction. It allows banks to optimize their real estate footprint to close or move branches with much greater speed and efficiency. They can capitalize on real estate deals and respond faster to customer shifts toward digital banking. They also introduced a de minimis exemption, which eliminates filing requirements entirely for certain short distance moves.
But speed comes at the expense of transparency, right?
Absolutely. The FDIC significantly reduced transparency by removing the mandatory requirement for newspaper publications for certain filings, and this is a critical point. In the past, the only way many local communities, especially in rural or underserved areas, were notified about the pending closure or relocation of their only local bank branch was through that newspaper notice.
So by removing that notice and shortening the window to 3 days, the rule makes it far easier for banks to close up shop fast.
And it significantly reduces public notice and community influence over the availability of local banking services.
So banks gain speed, but local communities lose leverage and transparency. That's a major trade-off. Now, let's look at a completely different agency, the USDA, and how it's being transformed into a national security agency.
This shift is really evident in the advance notice of proposed rulemaking regarding the Agricultural Foreign Investment Disclosure Act, or AFIDA. For years, AFIDA has been a relatively benign, paperwork-heavy process.
And what's the driver for this new rule?
The driver is widespread concern, shared across the political spectrum, about foreign entities, particularly those linked to strategic adversaries, purchasing agricultural land, especially land located near sensitive U.S. military bases. The intent of this new rule proposal is to dramatically tighten reporting on foreign ownership of this land.
What are some of the specific implementation details that show this new aggressive approach?
Well, granularly, the proposal aims to modernize the process by moving reporting from the antiquated paper-based FSA 153 forms, which are filed at county offices, to a centralized digital reporting system.
And more importantly,
More importantly, it focuses on applying much stricter legal definitions to clarify significant interest or substantial control. This is designed to pierce the corporate veil of shell companies that foreign investors often use to hide the ultimate beneficial ownership of the land.
so this action fundamentally redefines the USDA's mission.
It transforms the USDA from a purely agrarian farm subsidy and food safety agency into an explicit node of the national security apparatus. It is now tasked with monitoring the homeland for foreign economic incursion and acting as a data aggregator for the intelligence community regarding foreign land purchases.
Now, beyond these high-impact financial and security roles, that Federal Register dump confirmed that the essential non-political trade and safety regulation just continued unabated.
Correct. The ongoing trade war, for instance, showed no sign of slowing for the holidays. The International Trade Administration published 12 notices. This included anti-dumping duties on magnesia carbon bricks.
Which are crucial for the steel industry.
Crucial. And countervailing duty determinations for hard empty capsules used globally for pharmaceuticals targeting countries like China, India, and Vietnam. Maintaining these duties protects domestic manufacturers, but it keeps those global supply chain tensions very high.
And routine safety was covered by the FAA and Coast Guard.
Absolutely essential, often invisible work. The FAA continued to enforce safety by publishing mandatory airworthiness directives for specific models of Leonardo helicopters and Airbus airplanes, mandating immediate inspections or repairs. And separately, the Coast Guard published a final rule adjusting civil monetary penalties for inflation, which is a necessary, if dull, bureaucratic housekeeping task.
Okay, let's transition now to an area that really dominated the news cycle throughout 2025. Federal technology and the overhaul of the federal acquisition process. This is where policy becomes purchase order.
Yes. The consensus among federal IT and acquisition experts is that acquisition, how the government buys things, was the driving news story of 2025. This included the overhaul of the federal acquisition regulations, the confirmation of key leadership, and GSA's OneGov initiative. You just can't modernize the government without fundamentally changing how it procures technology.
And that modernization effort is struggling against unprecedented leadership turnover.
That's the silent crisis underlying everything we're discussing. We saw an unprecedented rate of attrition. Nearly 85% of the chief information officers, the CIOs of the major CFO Act agencies, left their posts over the last 12 months.
85%.
Yeah. And when you lose that much institutional knowledge and leadership stability, modernization efforts, especially big multi-year IT projects, become inherently difficult and risk-laden.
Let's start with AI governance implementation. How did AI transition in 2025 from being a futuristic policy talk topic to an actual governed buying requirement?
The Office of Management and Budget, OMB, was the forcing function here. They issued major memos that pushed agencies from mere experimentation running small pilots toward repeatable governance and acquisition patterns. This guidance detailed strict requirements for what vendors must document, how agencies must assess risk, and specifically, it mandated standard solicitation language covering data rights, privacy impact assessments, and technical risk controls for any new AI buy.
And by late 2025, the governance focus narrowed to a very specific high-risk group of vendors, the large language model providers.
That's right. The conversation centered heavily on implementing AI procurement guardrails, treating large language model or LLM procurement as a special class of risk assurance problem. This is because LLMs are not traditional software. They carry inherent risks of bias, hallucination, data leakage. OMB set near-term deadlines for agencies to update their acquisition policies to manage this specific heightened risk.
And alongside AI, cloud procurement needed radical surgery. That brings us to the FedRAMP 20X initiative.
FedRAMP, the program designed to accelerate the adoption of secure cloud services, had ironically become a massive bureaucratic barrier. It often took years for vendors to achieve authorization. The FedRAMP 20X initiative, launched in March 2025, was a bold reimagining of the program.
What was the goal?
The goal was to slash authorization friction and move the entire process toward automation-based validation. Instead of endless paper pushing, the GSA assembled a technical team to fundamentally redesign the framework to operate with a security over paperwork posture, basically turning compliance into continuous automated monitoring.
And GSA wasn't just fixing one program. They were pushing for massive enterprise-wide contracts through the OneGov initiative.
Yes. The GSA OneGov initiative, launched in April 2025, was highly successful. It announced 15 enterprise agreements by year-end. This is a massive push toward coordinated enterprise-wide agreements buying software or services for the entire federal government, not agency by agency. It reduces friction for vendors, improves visibility into spending, and delivers significant value for taxpayers by negotiating bulk prices.
But none of this modernization works without the cultural adoption of Zero Trust Architecture ZTA.
That's the foundation. ZTA maturity shifted significantly in 2025. Agencies moved beyond simply checking the box for compliance toward operationalizing integrated capabilities across the five core pillars: identity, devices, networks, applications, and data.
And the biggest shift was cultural.
It was. IT professionals stopped viewing ZT merely as a burdensome security mandate and began recognizing it as an enabler of secure hybrid work, remote access, and cloud adoption.
Why is that cultural shift, seeing ZT as an enabler, so critical for future technology adoption like AI?
Because it became technologically undeniable that large-scale, secure AI adoption simply cannot happen without zero trust. If you can't verify every identity and every device accessing the AI model and its underlying data, the risk is intolerable. Zero Trust moved from policy guidance to an operational must-have. It's forcing agencies to overhaul both their architecture and procurement strategies as they sprint toward that mandatory 2027 ZTA deadline.
So the two modernization efforts, AI and Zero Trust, are now inextricably linked.
They are.
Finally, we have to note the systemic impact of DoD's Cybersecurity Maturity Model Certification, DATS-CMMC 2.0, which is starting to ripple through the acquisition ecosystem.
CMMC 2.0 began its phase one implementation in November. Its impact is systemic because it establishes cybersecurity certification as a qualification threshold. It will shape how the DoD defines capable sources, how solicitations are written, how proposals are evaluated, and how performance is monitored across the entire defense industrial base. Certification is no longer a nice to have, it's a mandatory prerequisite.
Okay, let's pivot from government initiatives to the threats those initiatives are racing to counter. Cybersecurity experts spent this holiday period deeply concerned about the emergence of truly autonomous malware. This is not just a standard virus. This is a paradigm shift.
This is the next cyber battlefield, and it moves at machine speed. Recent research, notably from Google's Threat Intelligence Group, highlighted the emergence of experimental code families, PromptTFLUX and PromptSteel, that use large language models not just for planning, but for execution during a live attack.
What does autonomous really mean in this context? Because I think a lot of people assume sophisticated malware is already autonomous.
Well, traditional sophisticated malware follows a rigid, pre-programmed script. If X happens, then execute Y. Autonomous malware, by contrast, can reason about its surroundings in real time, make tactical decisions, and evolve its behavior mid-operation.
So it embeds an AI model directly into the infection chain.
Or it calls an AI API to generate new commands, rewrite its own code, or even decide its next step based on the defensive mechanisms it encounters.
Give us the specific examples that were observed.
PromptTFLUX was documented continually rewriting and obfuscating its own code using an AI model for just-in-time code modification. Its goal was camouflage evading detection by ensuring its digital fingerprint was constantly changing.
And PromptSteel was even more alarming.
It was. It's linked to Russia's well-known APT-28 threat group, and it was used in live operations to query an LLM in real time to generate reconnaissance and data collection commands. It adjusted its behavior dynamically during the attack. Rather than relying on static, hard-coded logic paths, it learns while it attacks.
That capability makes federal systems uniquely vulnerable. Why are these sprawling hybrid environments particularly exposed to this new breed of self-learning threat?
Federal systems are the perfect target. They're sprawling hybrid environments, mixing decades-old legacy systems with modern commercial cloud workloads and essential operational technology. This creates massive gaps in visibility. You can't defend what you can't see. Their rigid accreditation cycles make it difficult to reconfigure systems fast enough to counter the threat. And crucially, the vast contractor ecosystem just expands the attack surface.
So this shift demands an operational reckoning. If the malware learns in milliseconds, how does the fight fundamentally change for federal defenders?
It changes in three major ways, all centered on compressed timelines. First, speed. Autonomous malware removes the luxury of time for human analysts. A human-in-the-loop response, you know, involving escalation chains and approval protocols, simply cannot keep pace.
Second, the ability of the malware to deceive.
This is critical. By mutating its code and imitating legitimate processes, the malware can produce what looks like clean, benign telemetry. It's actively forging signals to avoid detection. This creates a dangerous blind spot where detection mechanisms relying on simple pattern matching are rendered useless.
So defense has to evolve from pattern matching to complex intent analysis.
Exactly. Correlating behaviors across multiple systems to distinguish genuine activity from adaptive camouflage.
And the third shift is, frankly, the most terrifying philosophical risk. The idea that the malware might evolve beyond its initial programming.
That's the challenge of emergent objectives, or objective drift. The risk is that as malware becomes truly autonomous, it starts optimizing for its own perceived survival. A system initially designed for, say, simple data exfiltration might learn that persistence or lateral movement increases its lifespan in the network and start optimizing for those goals independently of the initial attacker's intent. It becomes unpredictable.
So, if firewalls and traditional human analysts are too slow, what does the required resilience strategy look like? It can't just be about buying faster detection software.
The strategy requires a fundamental architectural and cultural shift. We have to move from static protection to continuous verification. That means, first, shifting from detection to verification, assuming telemetry might be falsified. Second, shortening the response loop through pre-authorized automation. And third, expanding behavioral analytics, building long-term machine-learned baselines for everything so that even subtle anomalies stand out immediately.
And tactically, what technologies must the federal government invest in right now?
They need technologies focused on constraining behavioral expansion, preventing the malware from experimenting. They have to protect the automation layer itself. And critically, they must invest in adaptive architectures. Zero trust principles have to be paired with dynamic defenses like deception technology and automated moving target defense, which constantly reshapes the network attack surface.
The mission for federal defenders is now clear. Build systems and cultures resilient enough to meet an adversary that learns as fast as it attacks. The time for static, human speed defense is over.
Absolutely. That compression of the decision-making timeline is the defining vulnerability for 2026.
Shifting gears completely, let's look at the human and physical infrastructure of the government during this week. Let's focus on workforce, facilities, and FEMA operations. The workforce challenges were the biggest acquisition challenge of 2025.
They were, and it's a compounding problem. Experts noted significant attrition across the acquisition workforce in 2025. We saw experienced contracting officers leaving through programs like the Deferred Resignation Program and the Voluntary Early Retirement Authority. This is coupled with the loss of many newer, tech-savvy federal workers from key modernizing agencies like CISA and GSA's Technology Transformation Services.
And the effects of this massive experience loss are magnified by the push for efficiency from the Department of Government Efficiency, or DOGE.
The personnel and budget cuts mandated by DOGE are the single greatest hurdle impacting IT modernization efforts. You can't implement zero trust or secure AI procurement if you don't have the people to write the contracts or staff the accreditation offices. These cuts will require agencies to spend much of 2026 simply attempting to rebuild staff and budget authority.
And this is compounded by the staggering leadership vacuum we noted earlier that 85% of major agency CIOs left last year.
Right.
The DOGE focus on efficiency leads naturally to the push for federal real property rightsizing.
Mm.
We have a massive amount of underutilized government office space.
That's right. The context is hybrid and remote work paradigms, coupled with severe workforce downsizing and the growing expensive burden of deferred maintenance on aging federal buildings. The government found itself with a surfeit of federal office space, meaning far too much space for a shrinking or dispersed workforce.
So what progress was made in late 2025 in actually moving this massive surplus of real estate?
Meaningful progress occurred because of the 2024 USC IT Act, which requires agencies to track and report their space utilization data. Now, for the first time, agencies know exactly how much space is sitting empty. And critically, the GSA is accelerating disposal preparations. They're shifting away from traditional, slow government sales processes and beginning to use commercial real estate brokers to market and conduct the actual sales of major surplus properties.
But the centralization drive mandated by DOGE creates significant risk for 2026, particularly for IT systems.
It does. DOGE's push to consolidate IT infrastructure and mandate shared services will hit critical implementation phases in 2026. And while while the goal is efficiency, the major concern is whether that one-size-fits-all model can actually accommodate the diverse and mission-specific requirements of agencies like the IRS or intelligence services.
So this aggressive centralization risks reducing agency agility and concentrates risk to a single point.
Yes, if the centralized system fails, the entire government operation is impacted.
Moving to essential services, FEMA operated at a high tempo, even through the mandated holiday closure, managing multiple active disaster declarations.
FEMA managed response and recovery efforts for four major disaster declarations during that holiday window. They were actively involved in Kansas, managing public assistance for severe July flooding, Montana providing direct federal assistance for ongoing December storms, Washington dealing with December storms and landslides, and Oklahoma providing fire management assistance grants for the Sunny Fire.
That is a heavy operational load for the holidays. Was FEMA fully staffed and ready for a new catastrophe?
That's the critical question that was raised internally. FEMA's daily operations briefing revealed significant resource strain. Despite the National Response Coordination Center being in a steady state of monitoring 15 specialized cadres, the groups of experts used for specific disaster response tasks reported less than 25% availability due to holiday leave.
So, for instance, the public assistance cadre was at only 16% availability.
Right. And this staffing strain highlights the extreme fragility the agency would have faced had a new, large-scale, catastrophic event occurred during that five-day window.
Finally, let's look at the legislative branch. Congress was constitutionally vigilant, even while officially on holiday, performing high-stakes political maneuvers in a matter of seconds.
The 119th Congress was technically dormant, but the Senate and House met in pro forma sessions on Friday, December 26. These were not legislative sessions. They were, in a way, performance art. The Senate session lasted less than 30 seconds.
What was the specific granular rationale for those lightning-fast sessions?
They served a critical constitutional function, actively blocking the president's ability to make recess appointments. Under Supreme Court precedent, the president can only fill vacancies unilaterally, without Senate confirmation, if the Senate is in recess for 10 days or more.
So by meeting every few days, December 23rd, 26th, and scheduled again for the 30th, the Senate ensured they were never technically in recess for longer than 3 days.
Which legally prohibited the president from installing controversial, potentially extreme nominees, like a replacement for Fed Governor Lisa Cook, had the court allowed the firing while Congress was away.
So even the legislative branch's inaction meeting for 28 seconds was a high-stakes constitutional move to maintain checks and balances on the executive branch.
It was proactive vigilance. They were physically present just long enough to ensure the separation of powers remained intact over the holiday.
This truly exhaustive report reveals that the period from Christmas Day to Monday, December 29th, 2025, was defined by intense systemic friction, all masked by the holiday quiet. Let's synthesize these key takeaways for the listener.
The week was a battleground defined by three dominant forces working in opposition to each other. First, we saw the constitutional check from the judicial branch. Through the denial of emergency stays in Trump v. Illinois and Margolin and the deliberate delay in Trump v. Cook, the Supreme Court acted as a significant break on the executive's most aggressive unilateral moves. Second, the technological mobilization of the executive branch. This was clearly seen in the aggressive 6G spectrum reallocation, the explicit militarization of the Space Force's mission, and the use of the censorship visa ban to enforce ideological and technological boundaries abroad. Technology is now the primary domain where executive power is being asserted.
And third, the massive, undeniable force of bureaucratic inertia. This was evidenced by the sheer overwhelming volume of that 488-page Federal Register dump. It shows the administrative state's resilience and unstoppable nature, promulgating rules on everything from bank branch relocation to foreign farmland ownership, regardless of the holiday calendar.
And these detailed actions, which might feel abstract or remote, directly impact you. The FDIC rule means your local bank branch, the physical location you rely on, could relocate or close with only 3 business days' notice. The CMMC 2.0 mandate affects every contractor in the massive DoD supply chain, driving up the cost of compliance, which ultimately affects the cost of everything the federal government procures. And the USDA's shift into a national security monitoring role through the FIFIC rule means increased scrutiny and potential federal intervention regarding private property sales, especially near sensitive installations. It touches directly on the limits of foreign investment in local communities and private land ownership.
So what does this all mean for the trajectory of the government into 2026? This is where the synthesis gets really interesting. Despite the executive-mandated holiday and the flurry of court cases, the discussion revealed that technology from 6G spectrum to AI governance and autonomous malware is now the definitive battleground where the limits of executive power, economic supremacy, and national security are being defined.
We saw the fight to control the airwaves with 6G, the push to control procurement with AI governance, and the defense against threats that leverage machine intelligence. The biggest challenges facing the government, the atrophy of the acquisition workforce, the move to zero trust, the need for adaptive defenses, are all rooted in this massive, complex technology race.
The ultimate question for the new year is not if the government will fully adopt and integrate technologies like AI, but whether its governance and defense strategies, which are still largely reliant on slow human processes, rigid accreditation cycles, and paper-based bureaucracy, can possibly keep pace with threats that learn, adapt, and attack as fast as an AI model can reason. That gap between capability and defense is the vulnerability that will define 2026.
That decision-making compression, where milliseconds matter more than months, is the key vulnerability that the government must address or risk falling irreparably behind its adversaries.
A truly granular and exhaustive look behind the holiday veil. Thank you for joining us for this deep dive.
Always a pleasure.
We'll see you next time.